a war of words, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton.
Millions of jobs, thousands of companies over the years, they've left us. We have unemployment. We have empty plants.
The new market tax credits that can bring businesses, government, and communities together to create good jobs in places that have been left out and left behind.
So I'll be your secretary of keeping companies in the United States.
We need to grow the economy and we need to make it fairer. The tide is not rising fast enough, and it is certainly not lifting all boats.
But 18 years ago, people were making more money in real wages than they make today. And today they're working two jobs. Some people are working three jobs. So they're older and they're working harder and they're making less money.
Just a more extreme version of the failed theory of trickle-down economics with his own addition of outlandish Trumpian ideas.
Get over it. We're just having fun.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the best thing you can say, it was a positive week for the markets this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up a little less than 0.2%. But overall, the markets were up this week, which is positive news. We're setting new records despite some difficulty on the economic front, with the economic numbers looking less than stellar this week. But nonetheless, money keeps flowing into the market as people try to find a home or find a decent rate of return. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Robin Griffith will be joining me in the first hour. He's our technician this week. Robin sees some major problems for the market ahead coming in September and October. Similar opinions have been expressed by other technicians. You'll want to hear what he has to say, why, and his reasons for it. He'll be joining me in the first hour. Dave Morgan will also be here. And he said, you know, a lot of these gold stocks, which have been producing stellar returns this year, are far ahead than the price of bullion, which is bullion is exhibiting some weakness here. So a little bit of caution here. Dave will be here to talk about that. Ryan Poplava will also be here talking about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, after the economic recovery began in 2009, following the crash, 2007-2008, the folks at PIMCO termed the whole environment in which we were operating to be the new normal. That's both in the markets and the economy. In other words, new rules. Things weren't functioning according to the old rules. But now that we've come a little further down the road from the new normal, or in the new normal, it seems like everything is abnormal. The economic growth rate, the rate, the way markets function, the lowest interest rates historically, and especially how frequently our policy experts have been wrong on the markets and the economy. So what we're going to do on the big picture today for the first part of it is to map the new abnormal and try to show you where the rocks are. That's the first thing you should know as a ship captain. Don't go toward the rocks. And so what does this mean and how do you deal with it? Because there's another hint here. The rocks seem to be moving. So try navigating in that one. And just as we discussed, let's see, wait a minute, stand by here. And part of that navigation, we have to go back to the deregulation of Glass-Steagall in the 1990s and the SEC and Commodities Futures Exchange getting rid of leverage restraints. As you watch politicos and the economic establishment try to deal with where we're headed, they keep changing the rules. So not only do you have moving rocks, you've also got moving references. So it's a little crazy, but with a little effort, you can navigate where we're going. And that's what we're going to try to do today on the big picture. And first we go to Ryan Poplava to see what interesting events happened this week as far as the markets are concerned. I'm trying to figure out some place to jump in here. I mean, I'm at a loss for words. Don't ever tell anybody that I actually admitted that.
That's the summer doldrums, right? You know, volume dies down, everyone's on vacation. And there weren't a lot of catalysts this week. But I think if I was to nail down a couple of them that I thought were pretty influential, I'd say quite a bit of interesting news in oil this week. Some of the economic numbers that came out were also very interesting, shed some light on kind of what's going on beneath the surface, essentially, of what we just saw in the jobs reports last week. And I don't know, maybe we can take a look at some of the other areas of the market. I was doing a lot of bond research this week, looking at treasuries, looking at the auction that happened, and very interested in what I found.
Okay, well, let's dive into some of those stories. Let's pick one. What's going on with oil? It seems to be picking up here from the low 40s, and now just finishing at the end of Friday, nearing the mid-40s. Some catalyst inventories, etc. What do you think drove the rally?
Well, at the beginning of the week, there was some interesting stories circulating that OPEC members might agree to a production freeze. There it is again, dangling that little carrot out there, which they did 6 months ago, and so on and so forth. The more important information that came out this week was the inventory data, as well as some demand reports from both OPEC and the International Energy Agency. We call it the IEA for short. So on Wednesday, John, after the American Petroleum Institute showed an unexpected build of 2.1 million barrels, we would have expected oil to tank, but it didn't. Because at the same time, we had this report from OPEC, and they were looking at demand for 2016 and said that they expect demand to go up. So with those two announcements, oil dropped, but it didn't drop very much on the news. And we have been seeing that short covering going on since the low 40s. So I think that was partly at play as well. Then the IEA report on Thursday said growth would slow in 2017. So kind of contradicting, well, not really contradicting, because we're talking about 2016 with the OPEC report. And IEA was looking at 2017, but 2017, they were looking at slower growth for global oil. And one of the points they pointed out was the strong dollar being a big influence on that. The rest of the week was, again, more talks about OPEC freezing production at their September meeting. And, you know, one of the reasons there's been this talk about this production freeze again is because of a meeting in September, but also because the Saudis are considering an IPO, initial public offering, for their Saudi Aramco Holdings. So to do that, the thoughts are that they might kind of try to help draw demand back into the energy sector, help that by kind of freezing production, cause some interest, cause some prices to rise in oil prices. And this is all for their goal of obviously trying to shore up their sovereign funds, which have been dropping since oil prices have been dropping, right? It was kind of a double-edged sword. They did improve on their market share. They really hurt U.S. production efforts, which were incredibly ramped up over the last few years with the Bakken production and fracking. So they did win that little war, but here they are. Their sovereign funds have definitely suffered from that.
Sounds like a lot of moving parts, both for and against higher oil prices. But for now, you know, I guess it appears to be stabilizing from the drop we saw since June, which was around $52 a barrel. Okay, so what's going on in the world of U.S. economics? The jobs report last week was a big print and a big catalyst propelling the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials to new highs this week, even though the follow-through on all of that was a little timid.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of that has to do with, obviously, the summer volume does typically drop off, as I mentioned. But, you know, I think the important numbers to discuss this week are the productivity numbers for the second quarter, and some of the other numbers we're starting to get now clearly in the second half of the year, giving us an idea initially of what the second half has in store for us. And, you know, investors have wanted to see some much needed improvement, right? The first half of the year was dismal. Inventory numbers were awful. But sadly, investors were left disappointed this week, for the most part, following the great employment report last week. So even as dismal as the first and second quarter were, the productivity report for the second quarter disappointed. And hours worked did rise. It rose about 1.8%, but output only rose about 1.2. So a huge spread there in differential. And that put the output per hour at a decline of around 0.5%. If we're looking at its annual rate, which is how most economists look at it. This has been the third straight quarterly drop in productivity. In fact, John, when you look at productivity as far as the beginning of 2015, you can see that this trend, this deceleration in productivity, has been happening every quarter since the first quarter of 2015. And, you know, the last time we saw this same occurrence in the data set was really back in the 1970s during the super bear market at that time and a couple of cyclical recessions we saw. So it could be a harbinger could be. You can never look at one signal, one economic signal, or even a technical signal as a all-encompassing signal that, okay, well, there you go. That's the answer. Bear market. No, you can't do that. But the productivity release wasn't enough to send the market into a correction this week, even though we've been kind of listing along here after that really big move in July. Volume is still very light, but sellers have been absent. There's another productivity indicator called the total factor productivity number. We call it TFP for short. One of the elements of that, I won't go too engineerish on all you guys here. The one element is that it has quite a few different components to it. One of them is the contribution of capital expenditures. We call it CapEx, which has been sorely missing over the past 5 years. When you compare that same push in the capital expenditures that we saw in the period between 1995 and 2010. So we need more CapEx spending. We just need it. But companies aren't feeling that comfortable doing that with all the global issues, the rise in the dollar of the past 2 years, the financial stress, looking at Brexit now with the UK possibly leaving the EU. And, you know, there's a lot that's going on politically. And obviously here we've got elections here in the US. So a lot of uncertainty. Are corporations willing to just put all that money into equipment and factories? Or are they going to just put it into their stock and lower their earnings per share? I think they're going to do it later. So the other big number that was announced this week, if we're still looking at economics, was retail sales for July. They were flat, John. And it was interesting because some of the great earnings reports this week actually came from retailers. So overall, not a great sign for the start of Q3, but you know, maybe back to school sales in August will kind of kick things up a notch. But when you dive into that retail sales figure, a lot of the weakness actually came from gasoline sales, which is, you know, this is the time of year when we should be seeing high demand. But if you take out the energy, you take out the food, and you take out the auto sales, core retail, we call it, was actually still flat.
So some dismal reports this week on the economy, despite the solid jobs report last week for July. But I guess, you know, if we're still drinking from the Fed's low rate punch bowl, hasn't been too bad for most people.
Bad news is good.
Yeah, bad news is good. So maybe rates still don't have a chance of rising this year. What do you think? You think they're going to have still sit on them?
Well, I think they want to. They really want to. You know, they don't want to just raise last year and do nothing this year, but they've got to do what makes sense. And they're very data dependent, which is good. If we look at full employment, which we're getting there, very close, and inflation is relatively near target, although I think the producer's price index report that came out on Friday, that was down. So we're not there yet. We're not where the Fed would be, I think, willing to begin raising rates again. But, you know, they're data dependent. Economics can change from month to month. You know, we could be talking a total different story, John, in just a couple of months here.
Any closing thoughts for our listeners on the week? Maybe something in the future?
Just some technical trends. Like I mentioned, I was looking at government bonds, the auctions this week. And technically speaking, we've got, you know, the Dow and the S&P, which hit highs during the week. Yet we're still seeing government yields continue to be in a long-term downtrend. Nothing has reversed there because the demand is there for these government bond yields. You know, there's been a rise since the June jobs report, which came out at the beginning of last month in July, but I don't see a violation of that long-term trend yet. And one thing, I was talking to Rob Bernard, who comes on our show every now and then, he's got 30 years in the bond industry. You know, we looked at that auction recently and just saw that normally you see dealers drop their bids to attract buyers with the onset of more supply really coming into the market. But it looks like this was actually a really good auction this week. There was a good amount of demand. I'd give it a B+. So when you look at overseas at negative rates, a 10-year treasury at 1.5%, that's attractive. So demand is there for U.S. investments in both bonds and stocks. It's an interesting situation. But, you know, John, we live in a world economy where everything is accessible, integrated. So money will chase yield and return. And it's definitely doing that, as we saw in that auction.
And we'll look forward to your input on all of this coming up again next week, the ongoing saga of the markets and the economy. Thanks, Ryan Poplava.
No problem. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. 3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Felix Zuloff. He's a longtime member of the Barron's Roundtable, and he's also the head of Zuloff Asset Management and of Zuloff Consulting, which provides institutional research and market strategy on the global macro environment. And you can also find more about Felix Zuloff and his thoughts at felixzuloff.com. Felix, it is always a pleasure to speak with you on our show, and I first want to point out that you have made a number of great and timely calls on our show in the past. You have an enormous wealth of perspective, so I do hope that our listeners pay close attention to what you have to share with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I also made mistakes in the past. You know, that's part of the business, but it's very kind of you to mention a few good calls.
Well, we will discuss those, and obviously none of us have a crystal ball, so mistakes are par for the course. But Felix, let's start with the big picture. How do you view the investment climate and political landscape we find ourselves in today?
Well, it's an environment that is completely different from anything living money managers or investors have ever seen. It's completely different and not comparable to previous decades over the last 70 years or so. I do believe that the most important change is the change in what we call in German Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist is best translated as the spirit of the time. I think you have to understand that John and Q, Jane Public, they feel that they have been mistreated by the political establishment because they pursued policies that were in favor of the establishment and were not very favorable to the average guy. And I think it has to do with too expansive monetary policy for too long, free trade that led to some cheating, illegal immigration that created more competition for jobs and made pay hikes less possible and things like that. And I think the average guy is angry with the political leadership, and that's true for the U.S. as well as here in Europe. In Europe, we have compounded all those problems by the introduction of the euro, a monetary union that does not work and puts the majority of the economies in a deflationary straitjacket, and really making the citizens of those countries poorer than they have been. So the promise of a currency that leads to peace and rising prosperity is just not being fulfilled. And you see that in the reflection of the political mood as anti-establishment movements and parties pop up everywhere. In Europe over the last few years, whether it's the Front National in France or Movimento Cinque in Italy or the Gilders, the Geert Gilders group in the Netherlands that is now the biggest dominating party in the Netherlands. All those guys represent the average people who are dissatisfied with political leadership. And in the U.S., you see it in the presidential race between the two candidates. One is representing the establishment, the status quo, that's Hillary Clinton, and Trump is representing and running on a platform of fighting the establishment and introducing major changes to the system. And I have no saying in that vote, and I won't discuss it, but I think Trump is reading the zeitgeist much better because he's using that change in zeitgeist in his favor. And we do not know the outcome of that political election, but what we do know is either the establishment adapts to the changes the public wants to be coming through, or they will get kicked out and replaced by new political staff that will run policies according to the desire of the people. The latter is a faster change, and the former is a slower change. But change there will be. And I think this is important because it really leads to major changes.
Well, after a terrible start to the beginning of the year, some ups and downs, the markets are now in positive territory, and many of the indexes are hitting all-time records. Is this something that will continue, or are we heading for a blow-off top? Joining us on the program is Robin Griffith. Robin, I'm looking at the numbers. We've almost reversed where we were at the beginning of the year. The markets are setting all-time records. They're not doing it based on economic growth. They're not doing it on corporate earnings, which are down five quarters in a row. So from a technical point of view, how do you view these markets right now?
It's not healthy, unfortunately. The two Western markets that have had the best rally are the USA, S&P and Dow, obviously, and FTSE because of Brexit. I do have to admit that if you'd asked me to say ahead of Brexit that on that vote FTSE would be higher afterwards, not lower, I would have got that one wrong. But because the hit, as we've had here, quite a big hit, was all taken place in sterling. So, in fact, all British assets are worth less now than they were before the Brexit vote, but it doesn't show up in the stock market, it shows up in the currency. Also, since Brexit, we've had what you might call a knee-jerk reaction and then a more considered reaction that we've got to get now. But the knee-jerk reaction was, you know what, this isn't going to be as bad as the fearmongers told us it was before we had voted the wrong way. Secondly, we rather like Theresa May. We think she's a good bloke, if I can put it like that, and she's a safe pair of hands, and we like her team, so we're going to make a go of it. That was the knee-jerk reaction, and because the hit was in sterling, the market said, well, we can rally from here. We were oversold. Plenty of short positions had to cover. However, we're now at the more considered reaction period, and I think people are now suddenly saying, yeah, but, okay, it is a problem. It's going to lumber on for at least 2 years to get us out of here. We've got to negotiate all sorts of things, and nobody quite knows what the game plan is. We're pretty sure the Germans will still want to sell us Mercedes, and the French will want to sell us some wine, but we do have to negotiate trade deals. We're not sure how that will go, and it will have global ramifications, and we're a bit worried. And clearly, the governor of the Bank of England said, I'm worried too, so here's a quarter point cut in interest rates, and how about a package of stimulatory measures, $170 billion. So he didn't do that because he sees a great boom ahead. He did that because he sees the reverse, and he wants to help cushion the blow. However, the rally that we've had in the FTSE was mostly on the roadmap we had predicted, which was that we would get a sell-in May situation, and this applies to America too. We would have a nasty low in late July, and it was the 23rd of July, and then you always get a midsummer rally. And normally, the midsummer rally goes about halfway back up again. Well, the whole rally has been 8%, so 4% of it we were expecting. It's the last 4% we weren't expecting, and we could call that Theresa May euphoria. And when we come to America, we were expecting that the Dow and the S&P could easily make a new all-time high because they weren't that far off doing it anyway. And secondly, as we know, many, many stocks in core America, used to be called the backbone of America, are still well into a nasty bear market. But the way these indices are constructed, you only need a Google, an Amazon, and a couple of others that used to fit into acronyms like FANG and NOSH, and that can make the index make the high. So we didn't get that wrong. Now, the thing that is wrong with the American market is not the economy or the companies. It's the valuation basis that the market has now gotten itself onto. I've looked at the entire history of the U.S. stock market. It has only ever been more expensive than it is once before in history. We are already more expensive in America than we were at the peak in 1929. That wasn't good. The time when we won even more money was the dot-com bubble in the year 2000. Just because we have once been even more expensive than we are right now, cyclically adjusted PE 27, I mean, that is frankly outrageously bad value. And history shows, if history has any relevance here, that if you buy equities on that basis, you have a vanishingly small chance of making money at any stage in the next decade, and really quite a high and ever-increasing probability of losing quite a lot of money at some stage along the way. So being at a new all-time high for those two American indices
firstly, it's not in a secular uptrend. And secondly, it isn't really in a bull market. It's a few giant companies going up. And secondly, what we always used to call the plunge protection team, or you might be called the Fed, just as other central banks over here, they clearly take actions to stop markets that signal they want to go into a bear market. They take actions to stop them falling by very much. And it's quite clear that in both Britain and many other countries that just such actions have been taken place. So we have the technicals that signal we should be or are in a bear market, but the official actions taken to prevent the markets falling down. There's one other thing, though, and this is by far the most important trend on any chart in the world. And if you take the U.S. view of it, if you go back to the year 2000 and rebase both to 100, the U.S. stock market and the S&P 500 and 30-year treasury bonds, what that chart says to me is you should not have been in equities at any stage in the last 16 years. If you had instead been in 30-year treasury bonds, just sitting there not doing anything else, you would have taken a whole lot less risk, had a whole lot less volatility, and you would have made a 50% greater return than you've made in equities. So in equities, we've been wasting our time. And then there's one final little bit why we might even be wasting our money, and that's the normal seasonal deviation that all markets have. We nearly always get the spring dip. We nearly always get a midsummer rally. So right at what may be the top of the midsummer rally is just at the start of the absolute worst 3 months in any given year. So between now and late October, if there was ever going to be a time when you actually held back from buying new things and accumulated just a little bit of liquidity and sat on it for a while waiting for bargains, that would be where we are right now. But at least in America, holding dollars is fine. Dollar cash is good cash. Actually, Japanese yen is quite good cash as well. But unfortunately, here in Europe, the pound sterling and euros is bad cash. So if our guys over here go liquid, we don't want them to sit on sterling. We would rather they hold dollars, or better yet, how about gold and silver? That's real money. And as you know, I look at the constituent stocks in a huge number of different universes. One of the favorite ones is the world's biggest 500 companies by market cap, roughly half of which happen to be U.S. companies. Right at the top of the list is the performance, Barrick Gold. When I then look at the S&P 500, right at the top of the performance list, Newmont Mining. And you go down the other list, you don't need to be a rocket scientist. You get the message, these proper mining companies are on a roll here. And is this normal? Is this right? And in our opinion, this is very early days into a precious metal bull market. What normally happens when you look back at how do these things go, to begin with, bullion itself moves up a bit, and nobody bar a few enthusiastic gold bugs owns it. After a while, a few more people come in, and then the really big, really proper mining companies start to perform. And when they've gone up enough, like about 100%, the market cap on the sector is now sufficiently large that strategists start saying to their clients, you know what, I think that cloning this index, and we probably ought to put a bit of money into this sector now. It's got a big enough market cap. It's prudent to do that. So you get what you might call proper long-term buyers coming in. And the next thing that happens is it's not just gold. Suddenly the silver stocks start to perform, and they start doing what gold does, only with bells and whistles attached. And then way down the road, and we're nowhere near there yet, somebody with a hole in the ground and a liar stood at the top of it, those start to perform. But we're not there yet. So according to me, we're very early into a gold and precious metal bull market, and it's absolutely essential to own some positions in this area here. And this is not about collecting dividends. This is about going for capital appreciation. And all around the world, investors are worried that their central banks are printing their currencies more or less into oblivion, or anyway into a debt mountain that we have no idea how we're going to get out of it. And in order to hedge that risk, we need to own some gold, which has for thousands of years been real money. In the U.S., people are very well aware that when they look back through history, well, actually, an earlier president called Roosevelt confiscated our gold. So if we're going to do this, we better get it where the bad guys can't get hold of our gold. But I think in the rest of the world, they haven't had that sort of precedent before, so they're more likely to buy an ETF on bullion or something like that. But we're already at the stage when proper mining companies, ones with operational mines, are not even exploring, are an essential part of a portfolio.
Let me stop you there for a minute, because I want to come back to a point that you said about the market. That thing that concerns you is the overstretched valuations. And one of the things that we've seen corporate earnings decline for five quarters, and they're downgrading even Q3, which could be six quarters. So stocks are going up simply by the fact that people are willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. Do we run the risk with all of this quantitative easing that the central banks, in effect, create another bubble because people are searching for yield, they're searching for a place to put their money? That's my first question. The second question was an article that I read that the Bank of England is having a hard time buying corporate bonds because a lot of owners of those corporate bonds don't want to give them up because they know where in the heck are they going to find yield. So if I got, let's say, a 3% bond or a 2.5% bond, do I really want to get rid of it and end up owning a bond that's less than 1%? Isn't that creating a problem in both directions?
Yeah, absolutely right. Your first question, I think we are already actually quite well into bubble territory. At the moment, I have to say, I don't see any technical signs of the bubbles ending just yet. So the great trend of falling interest rates coming down still seems to be the trend that is in process. And just because zero yield is at the bottom of the chart paper doesn't mean it can't go any lower. In Switzerland, they've issued a 30-year bond at negative yield. That's like saying nothing good is going to happen here for 30 years. And people say, great, now we'll buy that one. We agree with you. This is pretty unprecedented and weird situation. And I think that you're right. Central banks, obviously, probably Mr. Greenspan invented this, but it's been carried on by other central banks all around the world and being led into negative territory, not by America or Britain, but by Japan and others. But we're going into this, what Bill Gross called new normal, and maybe almost zero or negative interest rates are part of the new normal. One thing is quite clear. Many of the loans that people have got, the world is far more indebted now than it was. They cannot be paid back. So at some stage, there's going to be massive wealth destruction. There really is. But trying to call when that is, we don't know. At the moment, because as you said, we've got to get some yield. I mean, we need a pension. Where are we going to get it from? We're sort of forced, because there's nothing else available, to what we call a barbell strategy. What our work is saying, if you were American, you must own some long-dated treasury bonds. And at the other end of it, you must own some gold and some stocks. But the type of stocks you want have to be business franchises that are preferably bigger than a lot of countries, so they're going to survive. And preferably, we must need what it is they make for their service. And if they've already had a share price fall of between a third and a half, well, that sort of already is a bear market. And if we can expect a dividend yield of between 6 and 7 or something like that, we can live with that. We can take a few ups and downs, but we can live with that. And again, in England, we're getting a growing list of stocks, which include HSBC, Shell, BP, Rio's, where those sort of criteria are already being met. And nobody's saying this is the bottom of their share prices, but we are saying we can live with this sort of rating, because I use the analogy of a railway train going down a hill, hitting the bottom. The front of the train gets the bottom before the middle of the train. The indexes are the middle of the train. And then we won't better say the bear market is over until the caboose has got there. And on my work, the caboose doesn't get there until October 2017. It's as late as that. Incidentally, unfortunately for all those oil frackers who were hoping to make a lot of money, my work has been clearly saying the oil price is not going to 80. You're not going to make a lot of money. The oil price, having doubled from 26 to 52, is on its way back down to 26 again. It's already been 39, rallied to 43, but the trend is negative again. So you can forget $80 a barrel. It ain't going to happen, not this year anyway. However, if you're going to drive your motor car and turn the air conditioning on, the weaker oil price is probably quite good for us as citizens, and it helps the economy tick over. But I would point out that I think you're in what you call the driving season and the air conditioning season now, and yet, at the same time, every conceivable floating receptacle that can hold oil is filled to overflowing. When we get into October, when you don't do so much driving, the price is going to come down with a wallop. So don't get caught by that one. I think the next 3 months really is a very good time to be a bit more risk averse and just keep something back. On the upside, you may miss something, but the something you miss may not be all that logical to call, and it'll be very highly rated. I mean, I well know that plenty of the stocks of P's of 300 or 400 nonetheless go up in price. So if you own them, you do well, but that's not value investing anyway. And if you're going to own a bond, I want it to be the highest quality government bond. And I would rather hold my treasury bond than be tempted into the corporate bond market where the risks are dramatically higher. I personally think too high to go into many people's pension plans.
We know what happens when central banks keep monetary policy loose. We saw it in the 90s with Greenspan, with the bursting of the tech bubble. We saw it again under Greenspan and eventually Bernanke, leading up to the bursting of the financial crisis. We know when they do this, it forces individual investors to do things they normally would not do, to take an inordinate amount of risk in the search of yield. So can we predictably say longer term, and I don't know if it's the end of this year, next year, or maybe a year later, we know, unfortunately, how this all ends. You can only drive stock prices up so high, bond yields so low, before one day we wake up and we say it's over, and then there's a panic. And I don't know what event precipitates it, but we know eventually that happens.
You're absolutely right. I remember back about 18 months ago when the Chinese market was flying. And if you wanted to beat the world index, the only way you could do it was by buying China. And our advice was, let's choose not to do that, because although we don't know when, we're sure it will come back down again, which is what it's done. And I'm afraid about the 27 times earnings. I feel exactly the same way. I don't know exactly when it will be allowed to fall, but even good companies' share prices will come back down to much better value at some stage. And meanwhile, there are very few other things to own, and dividend is the best bit of a good equity. Gold is quite clearly being driven by some very big, powerful investors because they're trying to hedge away these risks, which are very abnormal. And if you've got the government of Britain or the government of America, you know, their bonds are going to be some of the safest assets on the planet, even though they are wildly mispriced by their own historic standards. I mean, nobody's saying treasury bonds are good value.
So, Robin, if I was to summarize here, given where we are, the overstretched valuations, and you know what it's like when you're sailing as we head into the fall months, the Grand Banks are no picnic. So I take it you're saying that we're heading into a dangerous part of the year as we head into early fall, and especially this year with the uncertainty of the election. So right now it might be time to take some profits and sit on the sidelines and look for better buying opportunities. Would that be safe to say?
That's absolutely right. You've summed me up completely well. And the normal time when you'd expect to come back would normally be late October, but this time you wait for the November result until you exactly know who the president is and what the policies are. At that stage, enough uncertainty will have been clarified, and you'll know what we're looking at. I think we'll be at better value levels, or plenty of better value will be around.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
The ECU Group have a website, www.ecugroup.com. And there's another website, which is globalinvestmentroadmap.com. And my main document is written for institutions, but I do put stuff private investors would be interested in on the website for free. But the main product that I do is written for large institutions. That's who I assume are the readers.
Well, listen, Robin, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best to you, sir. Have a great weekend, a great rest of the summer, and great sailing.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us on the program is Adam Sherry. And Adam, you know, people are familiar with wills, they're familiar with living trusts, but they don't understand sometimes that the way they take title to property may mess up their entire estate plan, create tax problems, liability problems, all kinds of issues that they're unaware of. So what I'd like to do, if we can today, is take the different methods of which an individual or a married couple can take title to property. And let's start with probably the biggest asset most people have, which is their home. So I want to cover the various methods from joint tenancy to community property, tenants in common, and talk about the consequences, the good and the bad of each one. And let's begin with the most widely used method of taking title to assets in this country for a married couple, which is joint tenancy. So explain what joint tenancy is and how it works, the good and the bad. Let's begin with joint tenancy.
This is a really great point because some of your listeners may already have their estate plans in place. However, a trust only controls the assets which are held in the name of the trust, which is why holding title to property is so important. So if you were to hold property as joint tenant instead of holding it as trustees of your trust, the way in which title is held is going to take precedence over the terms of the trust. So joint tenancy in particular is a way in which two people can hold property in which they both have an equal interest in the property. And following death, it has a right of survivorship, which means that ownership is going to immediately transfer from one person. They previously owned one half, and then following their death, their one half ownership interest is automatically transferred to the other joint tenant with whom they hold the property.
Well, after a downward start to the beginning of the year, one sector that has taken off like a rocket ship has been the gold market. Gold is holding up during a normally weak part of the year. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, let's talk about the gold market, where it's been, where it's going. Seems to be doing well right now.
Absolutely, Jim. In fact, it was an article in the mainstream press, two or three months into the new year, stating that gold had the best start in 35 years on a percentage basis. And that's true. However, you know, where do you put the starting line? So I want to be very, you know, straight up with everyone that, you know, started from a low. I mean, the lows in the metals, in my view, took place about the last trading day of November 2015, early December 2015. And many people thought that the rally in through January was probably about it. And yours truly thought that could be the case, because I think we did a show in the early part of the year and I was upset that the silver price had not confirmed the gold move. And I think within a matter of days after we finished your show, silver took off and confirmed the move. And then we had a lull and then we got another move and silver had to reconfirm the gold move. And it's done so rather dramatically, in fact. And of course, as far as I'm convinced, we are in the start of a major, in fact, the biggest leg up in the precious metals that we'll probably see during this secular bull market.
Well, you know, it's amazing because if you look at the HOI this year, it's up over 140-something%. You know, Dave, in the last bull market, there was always a 2-to-3-to-1 ratio in the gold stocks in relation to the bullion. That certainly is not the case this year. It's more like 5-to-1. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, one is, you know, it's on volume too. So it's not like just a few people that are will never give up the ship that will just, you know, dink around in, you know, small volumes. No, this is a major players coming in the gold market. It's confirmation, Jim. I mean, there's three things that I look at to confirm that there's a new bull trend. One is that the outperformance of the mining shares, especially at the top tier level, perform at least 3-to-1 better than the bullion itself. That's number one. Number two is what the gold silver ratio is doing. Silver has to confirm the gold move and the ratio has to be, and this is a art, not a science. It's my number. So take it or leave it, around 72-to-1. We've got to be below 72-to-1 gold to silver ratio. That's been confirmed. And lastly, what you have to see confirmation by like big players like Drunken Miller and these others that have come in and publicly stated that they're buying gold. You get somebody that I respect a great deal, Bill Gross, that left PIMCO and basically is pretty outspoken and really, in my view, is a, a major truth teller and says, look, you know, the bond market is such and such, but, you know, you really ought to have some gold. And so these are the three things I look at to confirm. I don't want to get 10. I don't need 10. I need major confirmation that this is the real move. And yet there are others in my ilk in the newsletter slash analyst slash reporting business that will still stand firmly saying that we haven't hit the low that we're going to see and that you're wasting your time in this market. Well, you have missed moves of 300 or 400% in top tier stocks. And, you know, my people know to put a stop loss, follow their gains up all the way. And of course, the biggest question I get now is, you know, when is it going to end? In other words, when is the correction or profit taking going to take place? And honestly, Jim, it's a tough call because the trading in the silver market, particularly gold as well, has really changed dramatically since the beginning of this year.
Dave, I wonder if you might spend a few moments and talk about the futures market, because as much money has gone up. In fact, a report in the Wall Street Journal came out on Thursday saying that gold demand was up 15% in the latest quarter. So the gold that trades in ETFs like GLD or SLV is substantial. But Dave, you and I know it is dwarfed by the amount of money that exchanges every single day in the futures market.
Absolutely. I'll try to be brief, Jim. But first of all, that the fact that every long and short have to match is true. Secondly, that until the contracts on either side are resolved, meaning someone betting the price is going higher closes out their contract, or someone believing the price is going lower closes out their contract, the open interest, meaning the contract is open, continues to grow. And we are seeing levels in the silver market of open interest that I haven't seen since the Hunt Brother days. People say they're all-time highs, and I'll go along with that. What people don't realize is if you go back into the late 70s, there weren't ETFs, there wasn't the SLV, and you know, basically all you had was the futures markets or mining shares. You didn't have everything else that you have today. And the volumes, believe it or not, in those days were, or the open interest, I should say, or volume, were very, very high also. But coming on to point, so there's a lot of interest in the precious metals, in the futures markets, and that's the place it is set by price. That is what controls the price. And as I've said often, the paper paradigm is what sets the price, but the physical reality is what's going to determine the price eventually. So what we've seen is somebody that's very well heeled, meaning they have lots of cash, is taking on the proverbial commitment of traders' commercial interests that have so far pretty much won the game all the way up. The price rises, they start a sell-off, the trading funds by their mechanical, computer-driven algorithms end up selling off their positions, and the open interest comes down and down and down and down. The banks cash in their profits, the public gets taken, and the game starts over at a lower open interest level. What's happened this year, Jim, is once they start to orchestrate a sell-off, like what happened a Friday ago when the jobs numbers looked so rosy and the sell-off began somewhere in the 70-cent area, there was no follow-through. And I've seen this now three or four times where what I would expect to see a normal sell-off and the algorithms start siding with the commercial interests on the futures exchanges, take the price lower and lower and lower, doesn't happen. It's a one-day or two-day event. Someone's willing to buy at that markdown and continue to hold, and the open interest goes right back up. So who's doing it? It's the Chinese. It's the Shanghai Gold Exchange. These guys are pretty much matching the COMEX shorts one for one. The contracts don't match. I think it takes two contracts on the SGE to match one contract on the COMEX, and I may be wrong on that, but that's the general idea. Regardless, the point is that really strong hands are in the paper paradigm. And to me, and I don't want to get too excited, but I must confess that it's set up for a bit of a short squeeze, Jim. I mean, it could happen. I'm not saying it would happen, but when you've got somebody that's willing to stand long on the futures and take physical at the same time, we used to jokingly say that was a Texas long, because that's what the Hunts did. They had lots of paper, but they also had lots of physical, and they were long in the futures market and were taking physical off the exchange. Boy, that puts a lot of pressure on the market. Is that taking place? It looks as if it is.
So as you look at this, and maybe you might also want to explain, Dave, how small this sector is in relation to everything else we trade on a daily basis, whether it's commodities, whether it's bonds, or it's stocks. I mean, the universe in the gold market is so small that when capital starts to flow in, whether it's money going into ETFs, which means these ETFs have to go out and buy bullion. And let's talk about the amount of bullion that's out there to buy. And it's likewise with some of these stocks, where the market cap on these stocks is so small in comparison to, let's say, the other large stocks that make up the Dow or the S&P. It doesn't take much money to get these explosive moves, because if you were to look at, for example, the gold indexes, which are up over 100%, several stocks up over 100, 200%, you would almost look at that and say, wow, this is a bubble. I mean, if Facebook was up 200% in a year, we would be thinking bubble. But explain why that may not be the case when it comes to precious metals.
Well, first of all, because they were so undervalued, I forget what the sigma was. Jimmy can help me out. I know your guys and how good your, you know, everyone at Poplava Securities is, but you know, I think it was like five sigma. It was unheard of, unprecedented low. So that's one factor that you have to think about. So to come off something like that. However, setting all that, let me state for the record that right now that most of your silver stocks and your gold stocks too, but you know, I look at silver a little closer than gold, are trading as if silver was priced at $25 an ounce. And it is not. It's trading at about $20 an ounce as we're doing your interview, which means what? Well, no one knows exactly. It either means that the bullion is going to reach a level higher than 20, or that the stocks are leading and anticipating, and maybe we're going to see a spike high, which is pretty much what I anticipate. And I outline that in depth for my website members. But I don't think we're at a point now where we're going to see any sell-off or correction. I think we need to see a move one way or the other. And I was at about a 50% either direction. I'm not anymore based on new data, meaning the last 4 or 5 days. And I'm much more favorable 60-40 or 70-30 that we're going to see some kind of move up before we see any real profit taking in this market. So the stocks are signaling that we have more to go in the bullion market. And they are overvalued on a relative basis to what the bullion price is. But looking at a broader, bigger, longer-term perspective, they're still far undervalued to not only where the precious metals are going, but where they would be, let's say, in a market that was not as underfollowed or underloved as the metals are at the present time.
So given this, that let's say the stocks have got ahead of the bullion, you know, one of the things that we see driving this going forward is central banks, the ECB, which got up to, let's say, 0.5% on their equivalent of a Fed funds rate, is that was as far as they could get it, Dave. And then they just cut it by 0.25%. They're trying to go out and buy corporate bonds, but bond sellers are not selling their bonds because they're saying, I don't want to sell my 3% bond when I know when I get the cash, I'm not going to buy anything that's going to be even close to equivalent. You've got British gilts below 1%. You've got negative interest rates in Europe. And I can't think of anything, given where the economies of the globe are going and where they are right now, of anything that's going to change that. But I'm still reminded, Dave, of that saying by, I forget who it was, that said, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, maybe it was Einstein, the definition of stupidity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. But that's exactly what they're doing.
Well said. And, you know, you're the one that wrote, you know, silver looking for a catalyst. I would echo that and say, I think there's a catalyst out there in the bond market. I mean, this is basically a confidence game. I mean, you know, can these governments make the interest payments? Certainly at these very, very low levels. Yes. But as you stated, no one wants to give up their yield because they're holding 3%. And as the yield goes down, these bonds become worth more and more and more. But at some point, the insanity is going to strike somebody, a sovereign wealth fund, a nation state, a large bond fund. Somebody's going to say, you know, I want to cash out. And will that start a cascading event? I doubt it. But what could happen is one of those catalysts. I don't know what it would be, or I have ideas of what it could be. I won't voice them all because it's anyone's guess. But we're in a very precarious situation. If you're actually giving money over a fair duration, let's say even a 1 year note or 5 year or 10 year, knowing that you're going to get less back I mean, this is insanity in and of itself. I mean, a bond is supposed to yield something, and it's yielding less, and you know it. This is uncharted waters, Jim, and I don't know how it's going to unravel, but I really am particularly worried about what the bond markets of the world are doing presently and where it's going to lead us.
So, Dave, given where we are right now, you talked about given where the price of bullion is and given where the stocks are, the stocks may have gotten ahead of the bullion. I know that in the precious metals market, whether you're buying bullion, whether you're buying coins, there's always periods of arbitrage. There's times, for example, junk silver represents a real value in the silver bullion market versus, let's say, straight silver coins. So where are the values or where are the opportunities in the metals, given the fact that you believe stocks might have gotten ahead of the bullion?
Well, one is you could ARB, you could do a short ETF that holds stocks, silver stocks, and go long the bullion. That would be one. Another one you could do, just keep looking for value. Our latest update at the Morgan Report had five undervalued, lower than mid-tier, somewhere in the junior category, but these are not exploration companies. These are near producers that still represent value and are undervalued. Another area would be across. In other words, you could take a currency and trade gold long. I mean, this is pretty common among sophisticated investors. You could short, let's say, the yen and go long gold, or you could do it in another currency. I'm just giving the idea. I haven't looked at the yen gold chart in a while. But those are some. The other thing to do is what I like to say and say more often, Jim, and that is sometimes the best investment you make is the one you don't make. I think right now, if I were not in this market as heavily as I am, I'd be on the sidelines. I'm not adding to anything right now. I do have one technique. I don't want anyone to, you know, that's a subscriber to the Morgan Report to come back and say, hey, you said to Jim, blah, 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 because I have one idea of how to capture in a very quick way the spike move up in bullion that I'm anticipating. But this is for extremely aggressive traders that really know what they're doing. And I'm tossing it around in my head whether or not I even want to put it out, even for my website members, because it's one of those things that unless you're really sitting at your computer, it's something that might sound tempting and it would yield quite a result, but it uses leverage in a controlled manner, meaning a triple ETF that could be employed to capture a pretty significant bite. But again, I'm just tossing around in my head whether or not I'd put it out or not.
Well, you know, you just gave some very sage advice. One is sometimes when markets get ahead of themselves and there's a little bit of uncertainty, you know, sometimes the best advice is just stay on the sidelines and wait for better opportunities. Dave, something I'd like you to clarify for our listeners, because this concerns me, especially when you see, you know, gold stocks up 100% this year, bullion's up close to 30%. There's this tendency to go all in, and you and others I've had on the program here that are specializing in the sector have always forewarned investors that, you know, no more than 10%. Maybe if you're young and aggressive, you might be able to put 20, but give our listeners your views on that, because sometimes people go all in, and we've seen this happen so many times, and you and I know this. The best example was when gold got to 1900 and silver at 50 back in 2011. People bet the ranch, and they got killed.
Absolutely. And at the risk of sounding too dramatic, and Jim, you know me, I've been to your, had dinner with you, et cetera, but I am a heartfelt man, and nothing really upsets me more than learning that, you know, one of my people or somebody on the street I meet, you know, or someone at a show or whatever tells me that they went all in, and especially on some story stock or something, even one that I've written about, which, you know, very clear. The speculative section of the Morgan Report portfolio, because we have three tiers, top tier, big money, safe, mid tier, not as safe, but pretty darn safe. And speculations is that. Money you can afford to lose. And when someone calls me up and says, you know, they put this much money in one of these speculations, or they've got, you know, everything into the gold and silver sector, it really upsets me, because that's not a sound principle of investing. And you can get hurt very badly. I mean, the beta on these investments, the amount of volatility that takes place in the gold and silver markets is extreme. And you've got to know that, and you need to understand that to invest correctly. So 10% serves most people well. Even in the almost impossibility that everything goes to zero, it won't. But even if you did that thought experiment that everything went awry and only gold and silver took off, 10% would more than cover the losses because they would go up at least tenfold. And that's just a thought experiment, but we saw it pretty closely panned out in 1980. And of course, real estate didn't go to zero and the stock market didn't go to zero and all that. But nonetheless, let me say it succinctly. Unless you really know what you're doing, 10% serves most people. And a lot of people with 10%, and let's say half of that's bullion and some well-chosen top tiers and maybe a couple speculations because everybody likes that big winner, you can sleep well at night. You don't even have to check your portfolio very often. You know, I mean, that's kind of the approach that a major portfolio analytical service called Ibbotson's and Associates did when they looked at the bullion market as part of a well-balanced portfolio. And they determined that all portfolios during any economic conditions were served well by 10%. And it was 10% in metals only, not in mining shares. And I think that's what I want to emphasize. And beyond that, as you said, you're young, you're aggressive, you understand this market. Maybe you have a couple of services that you subscribe to that really are on top of this market and help you. That would be more than enough. Of course, I have friends that have more than that, but these are people that usually that's their business. I mean, Mike Maloney obviously publicly has declared he has more than that, but that's Mike's whole life. That's his whole business. And you got to remember, he's got a business income to back him up besides his investing portfolio. So hopefully I emphasize that correctly, Jim.
All right, Dave. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at The Morgan Report, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, I've rebranded The Morgan Report because we look at value in the resource sector altogether, not just the mining shares of gold and silver. Secondly, there's a free report called Riches and Resources. There's two movies involved there. There's one called The Four Horsemen, which talks about the Age of Empire. And one that I got from our old friend, Frank Barbera. Frank called me one night, Jim, and said, get your scotch ready and watch this movie called The Empty ATM. One of the questions I get asked the most often is, what is it going to look like, David? People trust me and they want to know my opinion. And that's a documentary of what happened in Argentina during the 2000-2001 currency crisis. So that movie's in Resources Report for free. It's a hot link. You can just click it and watch the movie at your leisure, probably on a weekend or whatever. And lastly, there is an affiliate program for those that like to stack silver or gold, and you can actually sign up and you can actually accumulate more silver and gold just by sharing the information with your friends, family, or on email list. So that's it. Go to themorganreport.com, get your free Riches and Resources report, and back to you.
Once had a flying instructor whose primary rule of thumb was, when you get yourself in a difficult situation, A, the rules don't count necessarily. B, do your best to understand what is happening. And C, take whatever action is appropriate to deal with the situation. Well, maybe we could say the same thing about the new age of abnormality. We originally heard back in 2009 from PIMCO that after the economic recovery, everything was different. And this was called the new normal. But now the new normal looks like the new abnormal, because the economic growth rate, the way markets function, the lowest interest rates historically, and how frequently policy experts and politicians get everything wrong. How do you function in such an environment? That's going to be the major topic coming up next on The Big Picture. I call it avoiding the rocks. But what do you do when the rocks keep moving if you're a ship's captain? Well, you can do it, but you just have to know what the name of the game is. We'll talk about all of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.